Hi there, and welcome to the Skylight Books author reading series. If you'd like to learn more about us and our many upcoming author events, please visit skylightbooks.com, where you can browse our inventory, buy books, and join our Friends with Benefits Club. You can also follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook. To speak to a real live bookseller, please call 323-660-1175. Thanks for your support, and enjoy.
Please give a warm welcome to Jennifer Rumelin.
Hi. So I just recently figured out how this works. The first time I did it, it was really bad. I was signing books with just my first name, and people were like, that could be anyone. I refused to read at one reading. So anyway, I figured out how this goes, and this is how it goes. I'm going to read a chapter from the book. I'm going to explain what that chapter is. Then we can do a Q&A, and then I'll sign books, and then we can drink or leave, which you probably would figure that out anyway. So I wrote this book because I was starting to get to a level of success that was objectively successful. Like, all of my self-doubt and all of my feelings of anxiety and insecurity, it was like, oh, no, I'm actually successful. But I still remained really awkward and anxious and physically clumsy and sweaty and all of the things that I am. And I was like, well, wait, why are there no other ladies up here that look like me, sound like me, act like me, or at least they're not admitting it? So I wanted to show a different image of success, and I wanted people to know that success can be emotional and intimate and awkward and sensitive, and it's totally okay. And the reason I wanted that was, particularly for women, I want women to become more successful and be taking over the world more, and I want to change the ratio. And the only way we're going to do that is if we think we can do it. And if we only see images of this success porn that look like this, and they're blown out, and they have blazers on, and they look perfect, and inbox zero, and all of that, then fewer of us are going to go for it. So I wanted to be like, look, I'm a fuck up, but I'm still successful. So anyway, that's the book. The chapter I'm going to read tonight is sort of a bridge in the book. I went on 23 interviews before I got my first job. I was a fuck up until I was about 27 years old. Failed out of college twice. I had a failed marriage. It was not a conventional success in any way. And then I sort of went through media and found my way in it. But this was when I landed in a fashion magazine. I'll just read. Also, I still haven't gotten down that you're supposed to put a bookmark where you want to read. But you know what? This is just all part of the brand. It's fine. We're going to get there. All right. Here it is. This chapter is called Fashion Magazines When You're Not Fashiony. My editor was like, I don't understand that title at all. And so I wrote a footnote out of spite, which was, this chapter could have easily been titled How to Survive the Job You Have, When Life Gives You Lemons, or Square Peg Round Hole. But I like this title better. Suffice to say, it's about making the most of a seemingly bad situation and how there's value in every position you'll have. So just a brief setup. I had gotten a job, which was a dream job for me, except that it paid nothing, but it was called the chill out editor of Time Out New York. And I literally basically was paid to do drugs with people. Not really. I just a little bit of pot, but get massages and meditate. And you know, that was my job. Like, oh, is this good acupuncture? Why? Yes. So that's where I was when this begins. After 2 years working as the chill-out editor, I come to be hired at a fashion magazine. I say come to be because I don't go after this job. It lilts toward me and finds me one afternoon when I'm sitting at my desk, late on deadline, deep into a vending machine snack coma, Fritos dust dotting my cheeks. I receive a call from the assistant to the editor-in-chief of the fashion magazine. The editor-in-chief wants to see me. She's seen my stuff. She likes it. The call is coming from inside this celebrated building that houses the famous media company with all the best magazines, the ones that everyone talks about, the one that's in movies. It's a call you can't not answer. It's a call people would give a small toe to get. Still, I am reluctant to go to this fashion magazine. I am leaving a job where I get company-sanctioned facials during office hours, where I get to write about people who make acid trip art, where I smoke pot with Woody Harrelson, where my literal title is Chill Out Editor. The people at my current job are my people, salty and weird and wonderful. Some of them wear Christmas slippers to work. This job pays me approximately $3 a year. When the big, rich fashion magazine calls and the editor-in-chief offers me a grown-up salary, I go because I haven't paid my phone bill on time for approximately 47 months, and because I am not stupid, footnote, well, not totally stupid. When I arrive, the office smells like perfume and frosting. It's my first day, and the editor I report to is planning her wedding. She can't decide on the Louboutins or some other designer name I don't know. Everything looks too creamy. She is fatigued by this process. You have no idea. The cafeteria is downstairs, just a few floors beneath us. It is a stir-fry station, but no one eats the rice, and a sandwich station, though no one eats bread, and garlic-free hummus and garlic-free Caesar salad dressing. There is no garlic allowed anywhere in the cafeteria, someone explains, and there are only certain times you should go. Our office is located on the lower-level elevator bank. Other magazines on the higher-level elevator bank. It makes a difference. You're allowed to expense cab rides, the magazines you buy at the downstairs kiosk, lunch, sometimes drinks, but not too many and not too often. There's a free table filled with castaways from the editor's free stash. Off-brand body scrubs, velvet socks, books on gardening, sporks. Some people check the free table many times a day. You should not be one of those people. The company awards its most valuable employees with private cars and private drivers. The cars are all the same, black and boxy. At pickup time, they clog the Midtown Manhattan street below, like too many ants marching toward a single crumb of cake. The office is organized in multiple departments, fashion, beauty, art, copy, but it's really sorted by Chanel haves and Chanel have-nots. There's stuff everywhere, desks and nooks piled high, closets overflowing, the hallway to the bathroom lined with racks upon racks of clothes. It's a hoarder's frenzy of acquisition, a reminder everywhere you look of the caste system of the place, who gets to pick, touch, play with, and often keep the stuff, and who does not. The mail comes once a day, bulky packages in soft envelopes, giant boxes wheeled in from some space in the building I never see. Messengers arrive hourly, toting game show level prize loot straight to corner offices and adjacent cubicles. It's Christmas every day. Assistants keep box cutters in their pen cups as if it's a requirement of the job. Fashion editors get reams of clothes and sometimes jewels, but beauty editors unexpectedly pull the best haul. Marc Jacobs wallets, Gucci totes, elaborate cakes, and magnums of champagne to wash them down. All expenses paid sojourns to the south of France and front row concert seats. $100 candles, luxury line cosmetics, lotions and perfumes and perfumed lotions. They carried out the spoils each night in oversized shopping bags with ropey handles on their way to events where they will score more stuff. For the first few months, I don't really understand my job. I've been hired as a staff editor to edit and write, but there's no sense of order or scope, what I'm actually accountable for and what I'm not. When I try to get clarity, I'm told I'm not a beauty person and I'm not a fashion person. I'm a utility person. One night, an editor invites me to her apartment for drinks. When I arrive, before I go in, she says, "Now don't have class issues." The office is a powder keg of hazing and agreement. There's a groupthink mentality among the higher-ups, an entitlement to get and be given. They want the free clothes and the six-figure salaries. They want to fly first class on business trips and pilfer coffee from the office kitchen to bring home to their nannies. True story. They want a better downtown loft than the one they have. They want the one that is featured in the Homes issue of New York Magazine, the one that belongs to the woman whose husband is in mutual funds and not in investment banking like their husband is. They want to be profiled in magazines, and sometimes they are. Meetings begin with outfit assessments, examinations up and down. Cute, 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 cute. Or, you can't pull off that bubble skirt. I don't know why you thought you could. One day, a senior editor decides to give everyone in the office a Patty P nickname and goes around pointing and calling out, "Patty Perfect, Patty Pretty." And when she gets to me, "Patty Portly." Another day, when I attempt a perhaps ill-advised braided hairstyle, I'm told, "It's hard to make a pretty girl ugly, but somehow, today you've managed." I cry nearly every night after work for weeks. Everyone is not awful and everyone is not like this. Most of the people working there aren't. I make my own community of friends, a cadre of misfits and outliers with whom I will form deep close friendships, whom I will know for years. The boss, the reason I came, besides the livable wage, is brilliant and complicated, straightforward and intense, detached from, though still in some way complicit in the coven. I'd followed her career for more than a decade before I got the call. She's an editor hero. For a while, she's the only thing that makes me feel normal, okay, and like I can do the job. I do not see her enough, but when I do, I learn. I begin the job and remain to this day desperate to impress her. The first time we are alone in her chic, all-white office, I am so nervous that the corners of my mouth twitch and it is difficult to form words. I laugh too loud, a spitty chortle, really. I agree too much. I'm afraid I am annoying all of the time. I probably am. There's a uniquely intimate dynamic that happens between some female bosses and female employees, a tendency, at least early in your career, to idolize the person in charge and turn her into a mother surrogate, to make her approval paralyzingly important, critical to survival. If you let this dynamic go on too far, if you build up your boss as an infallible, bigger-than-life presence and tear yourself down as a lowly turd human, you will erode your confidence and distract yourself from learning and doing great work. Over time, I learned that the editor-in-chief is, in fact, a flesh-and-blood woman and not just a hologram of all of my professional aspirations and repressed mom issues. Over time, she confides in me. I find her acutely human. We hang out outside of work, but then she reminds me of the job, of something I did wrong. I remember the power she wields over me, and I feel afraid. We are friends, but we cannot be friends. I learned that the next job cannot be like this. After I worked for the editor-in-chief, I learned to have boundaries with bosses. It is necessary, but it is also a little sad. After months on the job at the magazine, I finally begin to assert myself. I slowly carve out an identity in a space that is solely mine. I ferret out precisely what it is that I bring to this strange table. I am not a fashion person, and I am not a beauty person. I am, in fact, a utility person, and there are not many of us around. I move stories along quickly. I edit pages upon pages each day, pass, pass, pass. I'm fast-moving, and I'm an efficient part of the assembly line. I feel proud. I begin to join group email chains and speak up in meetings. Initially, everything I say is wrong. I don't know what chevron stripes are. I don't know Goyard. I say gorgeous when it's obvious I should say glamorous. I call something luxury, and it is clear that I have no idea what luxury actually means. I offer up story ideas, and they are politely ignored or given the same ha-ha great enthusiasm you'd give a plate of steamed beets. But eventually, the percentages shift. Eventually, I'm able to anticipate the boss's needs, to replicate the voice, even to teach other people how to do it. I buy a fashion dictionary in the world's thickest thesaurus. In my free time, I read fashion biographies, and I study fashion magazines. I'm fixating on cracking the code. I become very good at my job. It is a job that feels not like me and not for me, but I find that this is immaterial, that excelling at it brings a level of satisfaction I did not expect. For 3 years, I am given work that no one else wants, sections that are considered unsavory by other editors, areas that women who pronounce lux, luxe, have no desire to touch. I turn this into a positive. Print editors hate dealing with the website. They print out the web stories on paper, mark them up with their colorful pens, and hand them over to web editors to input changes online, even though this is a maddeningly inefficient way to work, the equivalent of that bad joke about blondes putting white out on a screen. I help edit the website, I befriend the web people, I learn the technology, I write a blog. I accumulate an entirely new set of skills, skills more relevant and important than I even know, skills that will get me to my next job and propel me to an entirely different part of my career. Because I am nervous that I will be pigeonholed as a fashion person and limit the scope of my career, I continue to write on the side about topics I care about for publications I admire. I work most weekends, and after 11 attempts to pitch the same story, I finally see my byline in the New York Times. In my last year and a half at the fashion magazine, I make a wish list of everything I want to achieve before I leave. I do not include address the persistent chip on your shoulder or stop acting like an angry asshole. I leave those to-do items for some future me down the line. I consult this list every month to track my progress. I negotiate it slowly and awkwardly over time. Into year 4, I'm named deputy editor of the fashion magazine, checking off my last goal. 3 months later, I quit. My next job is as an editor at a big tech company. The dream has changed. I will never work in magazines again. That's it. It's hard to know when you're reading. I was like, should I just start skipping shit? Like, is this, am I killing them? Anyway, so that I feel like that's a pivotal point, because it was like, oh, this is not like me, but you just have to do work anyway, and everything worked out. Does anybody have any questions about the book? Hi.
I have three questions.
Oh, excellent.
I don't know what sporks are. You said sporks?
Yeah, I did say sporks. Is that a question?
Yeah, and then I'm wondering how you pitched something 11 times and got away with that. So you were 3 months in that top job, so you must have had some feeling or reaction to it. I'm just wondering.
Okay, so the first one, a spork is a fork and a spoon combination. No, believe me, nobody wanted them on the giveaway table, but they did go, because anything free will go. You learn that. I was obnoxious. I am a little bit obnoxious with the pitching. And finally, I kept pitching them different ways, and like I would wait like 3 days and be like, hey, also this story, maybe again. And then finally, I sent him the 11th time. I just wrote, once more with feeling. And he was like, okay, fine.
What was your story?
It was about gluten-free bread in New York City. And it wound up performing very, very well. But at first he was like, this is really boring. But it worked out. So yes, that was the story. And then what was your third?
3 months on that job, so you must have had a reaction to it.
I was 3 years into that. Yes, no, I lasted there almost 4 years.
No,
before, I just wanted that title, and then I was out. I didn't care. I was already doing the job. I mean, that happens really often, that you're doing the job for a long time, and they're reluctant to give you a promotion, and I had already been doing the work, so not only was I, like, really waiting for that promotion, I was also pissed that it was taking so long. So I got it, and then I...
The pay increased, too.
You know what? The pay increase was not what I would have hoped. And then I also found out that people were making way more money than me, because I used to be a person who was like, oh, that's how much a job pays? I didn't have an understanding that there were different payment plans. I just thought like, oh, it's like, it's minimum wage. This is what a job pays. But I never asked for more money. And so I was actually really underpaid at that job.
And then what do you think? I'm sorry.
No, go. Okay. I know everybody else here, so no, it's fine.
I looked at both, and so this I'm like totally confused.
Oh, this was lucky.
Okay.
Yes,
so,
okay.
What do you think of the genre of, like, Hate Your Boss books? And, you know, like, Joe Didion even worked at Vogue.
Yes.
You know, and happily, I guess, well, sort of she adjusted like you did. This is a pretty positive book you're writing.
Yes, I didn't want to write an axe to grind career memoir. And like the person, the editor in this is Kim France, and you know, we have a complicated relationship, but it would not be fair to put it all on her, nor is it fair to put it all on me. And I wanted to be really generous with everybody in this book, because I don't see what the point is of being really negative. And also, like, why would I want to commit career suicide like that? If I just talk shit about people and I'm not generous, who's ever going to want to hire me again? But more than that, I think it is that balance and the self-awareness that it's probably your fault, too.
But that sorority atmosphere is so weird, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yes. No. It was obviously. I mean, I was called. I've just announced I was called ugly and fat. You know, it's not a pleasant environment. But that doesn't mean that you should run away, because I got a lot of value out of that job, even though I knew. I walked into that job, and I remember saying to my husband, now he was my boyfriend at the time, I feel as bad about this job as when I went into the telemarketing job that sold death and dismemberment insurance. Like, I had this same visceral reaction, like, what the fuck is this place? And I wanted out in week one, but it was like, well, I also recognized it was a good job.
Did you adapt to the survival skills, like not moving your chair when people wanted to pass and stuff like that? Did you do that petty stuff?
No, I'm not. I don't have enough physical presence or awareness to do that.
So you had like a few nice people who didn't do the
pain? Yes. Yeah, I found some misfits and outliers. Yeah. 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 Anyone else? So you could keep asking. Yes, go ahead.
What about asking for a raise? And how do you know how much money to ask for when you're walking into a job? Particularly, I'm curious, as a woman.
Yes.
Where women are obviously chronically underpaid.
Well, I think everybody should be talking about how much money they make, particularly women. Like, I think we really have to, like, so I ask people, how much money do you think this job is? I ask men how much money this, because when I was at Yahoo, there was somebody who was doing the same job as I was, doing it poorly and making double what I was, and he was a man. And I will never let that happen to me again because I was so infuriated by that. So now what I do is, because I have not the best sense of money, I think of the highest number I can think of and then I add 10% on top of it. But I, you know, and I still probably am underpaid, honestly, compared to men. Diva.
When things aren't going your way career-wise,
yes.
What do you like tell yourself to keep going?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things, right? You tell yourself, and it depends on what stage you're at, right? I mean, and how are things ever really going your way? I mean, because jobs suck, right? And it's like, there's some, like, the ratio sometimes sucks less. Like, sometimes it's like 50-50, sometimes it's 60-40, but like, usually it's like at least 60% sucking and 40% good. Like, it's just jobs suck. So, but we all need to make money, right? So, I think that I just have a thing that I always have more to gain than I, or more to lose than I do to gain, and also I'm really competitive, so I just want to keep going. But I think that specifically what you're talking about is finding your path. That's different than as you get later into it. And I think that finding your path takes rolling around in the world for a while, figuring out what you want to do, accepting your failures as sort of part of the process. I think that's a different thing than like where now I'm just like, oh God, that conference call. Like that's a different story than I don't really know what I want to do, you know? Anyone else? Lily.
What were the differences between working in women's media and then in a less gender-oriented kind of tech company? Like, yeah.
Well, I mean, the differences were immense. Working for men is obviously most men, but working for men is a totally different thing. I had not been accustomed to it, and I didn't like it. I didn't like how much red tape there was. I didn't like how much wasted time there was, just like conference calls and just administrative battles and just overcomplicated of everything. But I'm pretty good at working systems, and in a big company like that, if you can figure out how to work the system, you can become very successful. And I did derive a lot of satisfaction out of that, and also beating men, and I enjoyed that very much. Yes.
What did you pitch last?
What did I pitch? What
story?
Yes.
Okay. So, what was your last pitch?
I pitched two things when I was working on this book. I pitched a story to Elle, which they took and. But it made me kind of change it a little bit.
What was that on?
I've gotten both of my rings stuck, so I'm going to have a hard time talking to you guys. But it's, okay. All right, I got out of that. It was about how I had this chin fat, and I went into a dermatologist, and she was like, you have a big fat double chin, you should have that frozen off, and then she brought in more dermatologists, and they were all staring at me like I was Rosemary's baby, and then, no, it was fine. I mean, it made a very funny story, like, I'm happy for the experience, and then I just had, like, a vacuum on myself, and had to go to work with a hickey, like, the size of a skee ball. So anyway, I thought that would be an interesting story, and it was, and then I pitched a story about every bad boss is a coward. And I had a really... Thank you. I thought so too. Oh, it got killed at New York Magazine because the editor was she was really difficult. And you know, I'm an old lady. I've been doing this, not an old lady, but I'm in my 40s. I've been doing this for a long time. It was incredibly humbling to have someone just be really difficult with me, be really condescending to me, and then ultimately reject me and tell me she would give me a kill fee. So I mean, it never gets better, you know. So sorry.
Give me your thesis on that story.
No, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. It's fun. That might be fun for you, but it's not going to be fun for me. Anybody else? Hi.
Hi.
I want to know how you stay humble through all that. Is it because you just remember your past, or like you found from A to Z? How are you still nice?
Well, I mean, I I find everything else to be bullshit, right? Like, I find, first off, I had so many bosses that terrorized me. I would never, the thing that I am most proud of is that I'm a compassionate boss, that I'm a generous boss, that I really think about everybody who works for me and really think about them and where they're going to go and, like, stay with them for years over their careers. And, oh my God, I'm seeing so many people, I'm going to cry. But also, that's just not who I am, and I was never going to change my fundamental being to be successful. Like, it's not worth it to me. And
you have a bad boss, you turn into a bad boss.
I mean, I guess. I mean, it did the opposite for me. I turned it around. I learned what I didn't want to be, but I also just am not comfortable in those. I mean, look, I'm a kid from a blue collar family. I'm not comfortable in those, like, I'm a big fancy rich lady. Like, I'm just, it's not my zone. So I'm down to earth because it's just who I am. It would be really weird if I stopped being down to earth. So, anyone else? Chris?
Yes, so I've read some of your interviews.
Yes.
And I know it's in the book, but can you talk about, say, You're at the end of a bad marriage when you're young.
Yes.
You're working as a waitress. Do you have a vision of where you want to go and how do you
No, I didn't have a vision, and that was something I really tried to dispel in the book, like these origin stories, like it was meant to be, and I jumped up on the balance beam, I got behind the race car, like I always knew, you know, just this thing. And my mom tells the story, like, you were always supposed to be a writer, and I'm like, that's bullshit. Like, it's, I really didn't have any idea that I was going to be a writer, more than anything else. Eventually, by trying out a bunch of things and failing at a bunch of things, I felt like, oh, this feels more like something I love. And then I was like, oh, this is thrilling, and oh, other people doing this makes me really jealous and mad. And like, I started on that path. But I still think that I thought the idea of being a writer was really highfalutin, and I couldn't conceive of that as a career for myself. And I think, honestly, just until recently, I've been like, oh, I wrote a book. Now I can be like, I'm a writer. But I think it's hard to accept those labels for ourselves, you know? And I didn't always know what I wanted to do, but I figured it out. Yes?
So it's a common accepted myth that women who want to achieve anything can't marry and can't have kids. Most of the female achievement historically has been childless single women.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, you know, that marriage question was so interesting. You know, how do you see, give us your advice.
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody has answers to this stuff. I think it's all trial and error, and sometimes you're just screaming fuck at the top of your lungs because everything's falling apart. But I think it is a matter of priorities and what you want in your life and figuring out the pie chart of your life. I knew I wanted to have a kid. I derive a great deal of pleasure from being a mother and from being in a long-term relationship. But when I was pitching this book and I was talking to agents, I was talking to a lot of female agents, and they said, you know, well, where's the having it all section? And I was like, that's garbage. I'm not writing. I don't have it all. I have some, and different times I take what I can get. I think that's changing, and I think that, you know, men are becoming more supportive and we're figuring out more solutions. I don't think we're as far as we should be, but I do think that we can't only want to have professional success. That, I mean, for me, the pie chart just can't be that, because that's not enough. I find that, at the end of the day, I find it challenging and exciting and rewarding, but it's kind of hollow if that's all you got. I think if you don't have a personal life that's growing at the same, or a personal resume that's growing at the same rate as your professional resume. But that was for me. Everybody's different. But I think that having it all is bullshit. I don't know. I just prioritized.
When did you realize it was a bad marriage?
You're really a hard question to ask her. Well, I mean, everybody has read this book, so here I am, nude for all of you. I got pregnant, and so I decided I would marry him. My parents had been teenage parents. I'd been raised Catholic. I don't know what I was doing. I was just like, well, I'm lost. Maybe I should have this baby. And I had a miscarriage at 4.5 months, a week before our wedding, and I went through with the marriage anyway, even though I knew before I even married him that I shouldn't. But I couldn't handle not saving face. I had that at that point failed so many times that I just couldn't handle like a public humiliation. Like that's why I went through with the marriage and then was sort of really deeply unhappy for 3 years. And then finally I tried to leave him and my car broke down before I even got out of the driveway. And then I was kind of like, okay, fuck this. This is like a colossal joke. Like I just need to pull myself together. And that, you know, I don't know what that was. It was 17 years ago, 18 years ago. And then I just did it. I put myself back through school and I figured it out. And, you know, I think it's better when it's hard. I think my life, I'm so grateful for my life because I saw the alternative and I was so unhappy in it and so bored and lonely. So, thanks. Anyone else? I didn't say this at the beginning because I was too freaked out, but thank you so much for coming tonight. Like, I'm so grateful to see all of you here, and it means the world to me. So thank you so much. I'll sign books.
You've been listening to the Skylight Books author reading series. Don't forget that you can listen to this and all of our other great podcasts at skylightbooks.com. Thanks again for stopping by, and we hope to see you soon.